The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
So I just finished rewatching it and made it to the end, where there's a really good stunt fall. I don't know if you caught that, when the headless body of the warlock rolls down the steps, and it's obviously not a dummy, it's a stuntman headless suit. He's got the legs going all over, so he obviously can't see.
I think the effects in this movie are better than they should have been in some regards. Like, I like the scenes where there's the lifting of the head. I'm something of a, I wouldn't say I'm a connoisseur, but I pay a lot of attention whenever there's a beheading and there's a head being handled in a film, because I'm always curious, like, how good is it going to look? How are they going to do it? Are they going to do the dummy head? Are they going to do, like, shooting an actual head the right way and making it look like it's detached? And they did a mix here that mostly worked pretty well. I've seen it look rougher in more expensive movies.
Well, it depends what you mean by well. I do agree, though. I think literally every scene with the severed head hilarious.
Well, it is inherent. Yeah, there's something inherently hilarious about it, too. Especially given the seriousness with which it is approached.
Did we already start the episode? Hey, hello. Are you listening?
Oh, hey. Welcome to Weird House Cinema. My name's Rob Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Yeah, we were just talking a little bit about beheadings in movies, disembodied heads, the living head off the beheaded, because that's what we have in today's film, in 1973's Horror Rises from the Tomb.
Rob, I feel like this is the third or fourth early 70s Spanish horror movie you have picked. What's got you going down this road? How'd you end up in 70s Spain?
Oh, there's just something about this whole realm of horror filmmaking. There's some great stuff here, and there's a lot of great stuff that I haven't seen. So it's exciting to me, because the film we're talking about here today, Horror Rises from the Tomb, is considered a classic of 70s Spanish horror. Like, this is this film's a big deal. So I had not seen it previously. So it was one I was interested in. I was reading the synopsis, and I was like, all right, as long as this one sort of stays within the parameters, this could be the film for this week. And lo and behold, it was.
So I didn't know anything about this movie going in, but I was certainly tempted when you shared with me, I think, a user review you came across on some website that essentially made it seem like this may in fact have also been an ego trip for a particular writer slash actor.
Yeah, there are accounts of Paul Naschy, the star and writer here, and in his ego. I have seen that written about, and yeah, this is I ran across this particular write up on Letterboxd. Letterboxd.com. That's Letterboxd. That's a great website to go to if you want listings of films, lists of films. And hey, we are on there. We have an account under the username Weird House, and you can go there and see all the films that we've talked about in a nice visual display. And I also have links to the podcast episodes on there. But anyway, this particular review, a user by the name of their name is spelled like Lou, L-O-U, but then it says rhymes with wow. So I guess it's Lau. Lau writes, when Paul Naschy wrote this movie about medieval Paul Naschy getting decapitated because of alleged Satanist practices, he knew it was really about the executioners being jealous of medieval Paul Naschy's good looks slash him being irresistible to women everywhere. When it came time for Paul Naschy to write a hero into the story to save everyone and their wives from the clutches of medieval Paul Naschy, he conjured up dreamy present-day hunk Paul Naschy. He knew that even if dreamy Paul Naschy wouldn't be able to defeat medieval Paul Naschy, he would at least be recognized as the hero dreamy Paul Naschy really is.
I'd say that's about right. So this movie, it was not directed by Paul Naschy, but written by Paul Naschy and starring Paul Naschy in at least three different roles.
That's right. Now, I think I would critique this this review is hilarious, and I love it. But it's not 100% accurate in terms of what we get out of the Paul Naschys. And we'll get into that, the different Paul Naschy characters. There's really one dreamy Paul Naschy character in this film, and he's pretty magical.
So I was watching this movie on a streaming service that is supported by ad breaks, and I was deeply intrigued by the fact that the movie has major themes of a floating severed warlock head dripping neck blood on things, including like a painting in the process of being painted. And so we'd have the head, it would dribble some neck blood, and then we would cut to commercial, and the commercials are all for paper towels and other cleaning products. Is this a coincidence, or has ad targeting got this good? Like, they can detect the contents of the film and adjust ads accordingly.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, when stains are at their worst, such as from dripping heads, you need a quality paper towel.
The other thing about the streaming service that I thought was funny was that it said this movie is rated TV-14, despite it being absolutely wall-to-wall severed heads, gratuitous nudity, and dripping blood all over the place.
That's right.
Euro rating standards. I don't know.
Maybe so. Yeah, this is not a film for the children. Though I have read that there is a quote-unquote clothed cut of this. So they might have shot some alternate scenes in which various characters are clothed instead of in various states of nudity. But it would be an entirely different film that way. So I'm not sure I can recommend that, even if you can find that cut.
Another thing I will say about my experience of watching The Horror Rises from the Tomb is that it had two features which may seem at odds with each other, but were both simultaneously true. One is that the plot is extremely simple. There are not a lot of like twists and turns and machinations. And at the same time, at least half of the scenes in this movie, I had no idea what was going on. By that, I mean, I could not tell you who at least some of the characters on screen were, how they arrived at what they're doing, why they're doing it, or what it means.
Yeah, there were a few scenes in this where I think I watched them three times and then consulted a plot summary to figure out exactly what the characters were attempting to do.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I really in the first half had a hard time keeping the different characters and their relationships straight. I did not know who was who until the warlock magic really starts happening in the second half. Then I guess it gets easier to follow.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, this is a movie about the ultimate occult power couple coming back from the dead to just tear it up. And so once they're back and in action, you're 100% on board. You basically know where things are going and you can follow the chaos. But you have to get up to that point, and it can be a little confusing, but never boring getting right. there.
It's like the Sonny and Cher of Satanism rise from the grave in order to get revenge on the descendants of the Inquisitors who put them to the sword.
Yes. But also I think they just want to consume human hearts, drink blood, worship Satan, and so forth.
Yeah. But in the parts where I had no idea what was going on, I think part of that is dialogue and dubbing. Like, this movie did have that quality of, I would literally be watching a scene with my full attention. I'm not on my phone. I'm not distracted. Full attention. But then afterwards, I could not summarize what anybody said in the scene. So there's a bit of that. But then another part I think that made it a little hard to follow is that the cinematography drifts more toward that dreamy style that you would see in like a Fulci movie, mm-hmm. where I think often our brains are trained to, we pick up on certain cues of how a scene looks and sounds and like, ah, this feels more like a dream sequence. I don't need to pay close attention to the plot because it's, you know, it's dreamy mode, except this actually is just the physical reality of the narrative.
The world of the living is a dream of the dead. which is probably not true, but that sounds like the logic you would hear in a 70s horror trailer, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think when it comes to, like, this movie's very memorable, I think, but there is, in terms mm-hmm. of like remembering lines, the most memorable lines for me are some of the dumb things that the painter character Maurice says. Our occult power couple here, they have plenty of times where they basically just say occult things. And while I don't recall the details, the feel of it resonates. So I would say this is a movie that is more to be felt than comprehended. And again, I had to go back and watch some things several times just to make sure I was understanding what they were doing. But to be clear, this film rocks. You should see it. If you want to see it, if you're like, well, I want to see this for myself before we get into the main episode, well, let me tell you where you can get it. First of all, as far as physical media goes, Shout Factory has the Paul Naschy collection out on Blu-ray. That has the films in it, Horror Rises from the Tomb, Vengeance of the Zombies, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, Night of the Werewolf, and Human Beasts. You can also pick up Horror Rises from the Tomb on DVD. I watched it on Prime, but it was not great quality, and it was formatted for television. I think the version you watched was on Tubi. It was letterbox edition, but of course, you're going to have ads that way, so it depends how you want to play it. I ended up going back on Tubi and watching some of the scenes again that I needed to revisit.
I mean, I'd say it's worth it just for the hilarious ad cutaways.
But who knows how the machine's working there. It may pick up on something else with somebody else's experience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, well, the basic elevator pitch here is, yeah, I mean, horror rises from the tomb. Don't worry, if you watch this film, horror will rise from the tomb. The ultimate occult power couple won't let death stand in their way.
It's a tender love story about a warlock and his head. Boy meets girl, boy loses head, boy regains head, boy gets revenge, boy loses head.
Well, boy loses head, boy loses girl.
Yeah.
Boy regains head, boy regains girl, boy loses girl, boy loses head. That's the full plot summary.
Dinosaurs eat boy, woman inherits the earth.
Yeah.
From the dark and mysterious Middle Ages, full of mystery and violence, there now comes to the screen, Fear Rises from the Tomb, a curse which would bring these people to the most terrifying situations. Fear Rises from the Tomb, with all the mystery and terror of medieval rites and witchcraft. The infernal powers of evil persecuting these defenseless beings. Fear Rises from the Tomb. A Pro Films production, directed by Carlos Aurez.
7 moons have passed. Today we shall take them. I want, when the supreme day comes, that they are sufficiently prepared for the sacrifice.
All right, well, let's talk a bit about the humans involved in this before we get back into the plot. So as we mentioned already, Paul Naschy did not direct this. It was directed by Carlos Aurez, who lived 1937 through 2008. He was a Spanish director of various erotic dramas and Paul Naschy horror films, including Curse of the Devil from 73, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll from 74, and The Mummy's Revenge from 75. As a producer, he helped bring the films Alien Predator from 86 into
being.
Hold on.
Not Alien versus Predator, but no. Just Alien Predator.
Alien Predator. He also produced or was one of the producers on Claudio Fragasso of Troll 2 fame's 1984 film Monster Dog, starring Alice Cooper.
What? I don't think I knew about that. Or if
I haven't seen it, but I've seen the posters and some stills from it. It looks wonderfully awful. And as you might recall from our episode on Troll 2, I mean, Claudio Fragasso took this very seriously, this filmmaking thing. And so he's exactly the sort of director you want directing a film called Monster Dog starring Alice Cooper.
So if Troll 2 was a film about how he believed that meat eaters were being persecuted by vegetarians, what is the meaning of Monster Dog?
I'm not sure, but if the poster is any indication, he pursues this this topic, this subject matter, via some sort of like fleshless killer Doberman.
Gross.
Yeah.
All right, so that's the director technically, but I don't know. The vibe I get is that pretty much top to bottom, this is the Paul Naschy show.
That's right.
So who is this guy?
So Paul Naschy, yeah, who has story and screenplay credits on this. He plays our warlock character, Alaric de Marnac. He also plays, this is complicated, but Alaric's traitorous brother, Armand de Marnac. And he also plays Armand's descendant, Hugo de Marnac, in the present. So three different roles. And all of them have a different feel to them.
Though it's weird because his descendant character is not like the inheritor of the warlock throne. He, in fact, he basically just treats his own descendant as another enemy.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like there's a different energy to Hugo. I mean, Hugo, the modern day Paul Naschy character in this, which I mean 1970s. He's still kind of a stylish dude, but he's also, he's doomed. He can't stand up to the warlock. Yeah. He's not like, I am the descendant of Alaric, and therefore I'm the one who can defeat him. No, it's not going to go that way at all.
No, in fact, he's a doomed skeptic, and he's the guy who, like, doesn't believe in the power of spirit mediums, so, you know, things are not going to end well for him. Movies like this do not reward people who don't believe in the supernatural. Yeah. And so, Naschy, but also I would say about Naschy's character, this is not unique to him, but he is, this movie has multiple contemporary characters who are very much like turtleneck sweater tucked into pants guys.
Yep. They just wander into all this where they're like, yeah, let's have a seance at this old estate. Let's call back. Let's see if we can call up the spirit of this dead warlock. That sounds like a good time. We'll have some wine. We'll smoke a little bit. What could possibly go wrong?
I would say Paul Naschy's energy as an actor is a strange combination, something I'm not really used to. In one sense, he has very traditional, almost kind of like boxy or rectangular masculine movie star energy. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of who to compare, you know, like a Ed Begley Sr. or something. But then on the other half, kind of a weirdo worminess that is almost the likes of Peter Lorre.
Yeah. He has his physicality is interesting to behold. Yeah, because on one level, I mean, he's clearly ripped. As we'll discuss, he's a former professional weightlifter. So he's he's quite a physical specimen. And yes, he does have this kind of wormy quality to him. He has the natural energy for playing this eternal outsider, this warlock that was beheaded in the past and now has to murder his way into being again in the present. So some of you might be wondering, well, who is Paul Naschy? We're talking about him. He sounds pretty great. Well, he is, in many people's words, the Lon Chaney Jr. of Spanish horror cinema.
Wow.
So he was born Jacinto Molina, but he assumed the name Paul Naschy for acting. And yeah, he plays three separate characters in this film, also wrote the screenplay. And this is a guy, we can't really appreciate the full richness of Paul Naschy in a single episode of Weird House Cinema, but I feel like this is a really fun film and a great introduction to him at least. So this is a guy who was born into a successful furrier's family during the Spanish Civil War, who then began to pursue a serious adult life of professional weightlifting and architecture. But deep down, he only wanted one thing. He wanted to be the Wolfman.
The Wolfman?
The Wolfman. Yeah, I mean, from what I've read, like, he grew up, you know, idolizing these old horror movies, and especially the Wolfman roles, the Lon Chaney Jr. sort of roles, and fate would deliver him in that direction. So he started out in various uncredited and sometimes rumored roles in various 1960s Spanish productions, stuff like El Cid, an episode of the TV show I Spy. But then in 1968, he wrote and starred in a film that was originally titled Mark of the Werewolf, but then on the American Groundhouse circuit, it had the name Frankenstein's Bloody Terror, in which he played werewolf Waldemar Daninsky for the first of many, many times.
So this was a franchise.
Yeah, yeah. He did, I think it's like a dozen of these.
Wow.
With titles like Assignment Terror, The Werewolf versus the Vampire Woman, The Fury of the Wolfman, Dr. Jekyll versus the Werewolf, Curse of the Devil, Night of the Howling Beast, Night of the Werewolf, The Beast and the Magic Sword, Howl of the Devil, Lycanthropus, The Moonlight Murders, and Tomb of the Werewolf. Most of these films are from the 70s and 80s, but they ultimately span five decades.
Whoa.
And they're not a continuous narrative by any means, with the plots varying wildly. Like, there's some where he goes to Asia and, like, goes to Tibet and Japan to try and treat his lycanthropy. A number of them look phenomenal, and they're just total werewolf features.
Well, I feel like this sheds new light on a major flub in the movie that really seems like it should have been caught, which is that in the English dub, at least, there's one part where they try to say the word lycanthropes, mm-hmm. but instead they say, I think, Lincolnthropes, like President Lincoln.
Huh. Yeah, yeah. I noticed that. I actually went back and looked at that on Tubi with the captions on, and the captions for this one said, "You have empires in Lincoln's robes," instead of "You are vampires and Lincolnthropes."
Lycanthropes.
But they said Lincolnthropes. Yeah.
Lincolnthropes. Yeah.
Lincolnthrope. The dub says Lincolnthropes. They mean like they're talking about lycanthropy. But yeah. But we'll come back to the formal charges against Alaric in a bit.
Okay.
But back to Naschy here. Mostly it was this werewolf character that he returned to, but the warlock character in this, Alaric, he does come back in a later 1982 film called Panic Beats, apparently, and plays the character once more.
Is that about, does he become a disco warlock? What's the Beats refer to?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Comes back from the grave. But it may not even be connected, because like I say, many of these werewolf films, it's not like it's a concise narrative. It's like, let's bring this guy back again. Let's have another adventure. It doesn't mean it has to actually make sense or be stitched into the grand fabric of the thing.
Okay, I see. Like, you can have many Dracula movies, but they're not like all direct sequels to each other with continuous or plot continuity.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, now, but I am thinking Beats, because you look at Naschy as the warlock in this movie, and he does look like he could tear up the dance floor. Like,
yeah.
He would get out there in the lights. I mean, he'd be doing the whole, the pointing dance, the John Travolta one.
I know the one. I don't know what it's called.
Okay.
So just a little more on Naschy here. I looked into him a bit. I was reading an article, actually a chapter in a book titled An Icon Rises from the Grave, The 21st Century Cult Stardom of Paul Naschy, written by Andy Willis. Willis writes that Naschy was central to, quote, the development, revival, and reinvention of horror cinema in Spain. The paper mostly centers around the cult-like revival of appreciation for Naschy late in his life and career as film fans and filmmakers in Spain and beyond began to reevaluate his films. But it does point out that, yeah, he was very much operating in a time when horror was seen as very lowbrow in Spanish cinema. Like, if you had any self-respect, you'd be working in serious cinema. And if you were doing horror, then, like, what are you doing?
But what was serious cinema at the time? Peplum movies, like the sword and sandal stuff?
Yeah. Just serious dramas about history and so forth. Nothing about... I mean, this is about history, though. This is about an historic warlock. So I don't know why the industry was so down on this film at the time. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year. Equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, well, we'll come back. We'll discuss more about this this wonderful performance as we continue. But there are other human beings we need to mention, at least in passing.
Okay.
We mentioned earlier, this is a power couple. It's not just Alaric. It's Alaric and Mabil. He has to bring Mabil back to life. Mabil is played by Helga Linnaeus. Helga is back. She was the titular Lorelei from The Lorelei's Grasp, the gorgeous redhead German-born actor who made a name for herself, mostly in Spanish cinema. Both of these films came out in 73. So if you want to hear more about her, go back to that episode. But she was born in 1931. As of this recording, is still alive. And she worked from 1941 through 2006 and played a lot of femme fatales, characters in horror movies, various genre films, and yeah, it was pretty big in Spanish cinema. And in this, she once more gets to absolutely slay multiple people and also consume their hearts.
Yeah, I was noticing incredible amounts of overlap with The Lorelei's Grasp. I was not prepared for how much these movies would have in common, even down to what looked like, it could be just a coincidence, but what looked like the same shooting locations.
You're like, talking about like that coastline, that real dreary coastline?
Yeah. The dreary lakeside. It looked exactly like the lake in Lorelei's Grasp, and I would almost be surprised if it was not shot in the same place, but maybe, I don't know.
I think the actual, I don't know about the lake, but the actual estate that we see, I believe, was in Paul Nashe's family. Like that was his family's estate there that they filmed on.
But it's not just that. Okay, so both movies feature Helga Linnaeus as a kind of, I don't know, loosely a vampiress of sorts, some kind of, you know, creature that comes back from the grave or comes back through history to slash people with fingernails, like in ways that leave these, like, you know, parallel slashes on their bodies and then extract their hearts and eat them. Both movies are about this.
Right. Though in The Lorelei, she changes into an actual monster. And in this movie, she just gets more naked.
That's true. But she still does the fingernail slash.
She does.
This movie has Wolverine style slashing,
but she's great in this. She really vamps it up.
Yes, there are great scenes where she and the warlock are arguing about, you know, when they're going to eat hearts. Are we going to eat hearts now, or are we going to have to eat them later?
Yeah. What is the plan? When are we praising Satan right now? No, we need to wait. There's so many moons we need to wait. The exact details of their plan are maybe a little vague, but
she makes a good point. I mean, he's like, no, we need to, we'll do the sacrifice to Satan later, and then we'll eat hearts then. And I think she makes the point that, but if we were hangry until then, we're going to be making bad decisions. So we need to eat at least one heart now.
Yeah. And she's like, honey, we've been dead for a long time. We've got to eat.
Yeah.
All right. So these are the two most impressive actors in the film, but we have some other roles worth mentioning. Emma Cohen plays, who lived 1946 through 2016, plays the character Elvira. Not to be confused with Elvira, the horror host. So Emma Cohen was a Spanish actor, as well as a writer and director. In fact, in 2011, she apparently directed a short film adaptation of Jorge Luis Borges' The Aleph. She was also the longtime partner of Peruvian-born Spanish director Fernán Gómez till his death. But before this, she did a lot of B-movies and horror films in the 70s, including 75's Night of the Walking Dead, Jess Franco's 1975 Count Dracula. That's one that starred Christopher Lee as Dracula, Herbert Lom as Van Helsing, and Klaus Kinski as quote-unquote Renfeared. I don't know why he's Renfeared in the IMDb credits, but he is.
Huh.
Cohen also had an uncredited role in 1970's Nicholas in Alexandria. And she's our final girl. She's the one of the two daughters of one of the villagers in the place that they go to.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to admit that I, again, had a hard time keeping the different characters and the human characters and their relationships straight. So if you're asking, like, who's married to who or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah. I had to go back and, like, at first I was like, I guess this was Hugo's wife, but it's not. No, it's not okay. Hugo's wife. That's a different character entirely. We'll summarize all that in a bit.
Okay, there were a number of laugh out loud moments for me in this movie, but I would say the biggest one, the best one, is a scene where we have a guy who's been seeing visions of dark eyes staring at him in the night, and he can't stop seeing them when he closes his eyes, so he's got to paint. He's a painter, and he's like painting on a canvas, and then suddenly above the canvas appears a laughing severed head that's just going ho 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 ho, and dripping blood all over the painting, and it's so good. But this painter, like, his dopiness makes it so much better.
Yes, he's haunted by the head of Alaric, and he's like, I don't know what it is. I keep seeing this head. I gotta paint it. And he's and he's painting this like sub night gallery quality painting, you know.
Yes,
of this headless body holding not Alaric's head, but modern Paul Nashe's character's Hugo's head. It's pretty great. But yeah, this is this painter character, Maurice, was played by Victor Barrera. I couldn't find any dates for this actor, but yeah, he's a wonderful doomed idiot in this. the character is the actor. Barrera appeared in such Spanish films as 1970s In the Folds of the Flesh, the 73 Nashe film Count Dracula's Great Love, and also the Nashe film Hunchback of the Morgue, as well as the 1973 film Green Inferno.
Who was Count Dracula's Great Love?
I don't know. I haven't seen it. I'm guessing. I mean, it could be his career. You know, he married to his work.
Right.
But I imagine it's some woman generally. That's probably going to be the way it's going
to go. I am married to the blood.
Yeah. Now, one more thing about Barrera. He was also in the 73 Judy Geeson film A Candle for the Devil. And as a director and writer, he did the 1978 film The Terrorist.
He also tucks his turtlenecks into his pants.
He does, yes. Now, we're going to skip on the rest of the actors here, though there are some other fun performances, but skip into the music. Carmelo A. Bernala did the music. He lived 1929 through 2002, and all I have to say is I hope you like creepy organ music and weird percussion sounds, because this film is loaded with it.
Yeah, it's got this steady, slow ascending organ melody that just repeats and repeats and repeats. Honestly, it got a little monotonous for me.
I thought it fit this film like a glove. I'm not saying it would work in every film. I'm not saying I need a copy of it or I'm looking for a high-grade vinyl release. But for this film, I thought it worked.
Yeah, it's the appropriate vibe. But you'll hear it quite a few times.
Now, Bernala here, he was a longtime Spanish composer of many films, including 74's Torment and 73's Count Dracula's Great Love.
Oh, he wrote the love theme from Count Dracula's Great Love.
One assumes. One more note about a person in this. There's a special effects. The special effects were by Antonio Molina. And I don't have dates for him, but this is a guy that apparently has been working in special effects since the 1960s, starting with 1964's, this is actually the Barry Sullivan film Pyro, The Thing Without a Face, that we referenced in our Fiend Without a Face episode. But Molina here is apparently still working today in Spanish productions, and he even worked on 6 episodes of Game of Thrones.
Wow.
He also served as an armorer supervisor in the Spain unit for such big films as Wonder Woman 1984 and Terminator Dark Fate. So kind of a cool connection there. This is not a film that you watch and you think, wow, I guess they had just tons of money to spend on special effects.
No.
So again, as I kind of alluded to earlier, I feel like the effects in this film, such as they are, look pretty good.
Though it is that early 70s Euro style of like very bright red, almost orange blood.
Yeah, yeah, it's alarming. Maybe that's why I got the TV 14.
Perhaps, yeah.
All right, well, let's bust into the plot a little bit. Joe, take us back to the mid-15th century.
Is that when it is? Mid-15th century? I think they say.
I think that's what the narration says, yeah.
This movie begins with the world's most depressing parade. You're watching like some people kind of tromp through a vast... we see them like on a plain with mountains in the background. So it's the kind of landscape that maybe looks like if it had been the true colors, it would have been beautiful. But instead, it looks just profoundly, deeply unhappy. And it kind of reminds me of some of the landscapes in Monty Python and the Holy Grail in that way. That, like, something about the film style and the way the colors come through just makes the landscape very drab and unpleasant.
Mm-hmm. But it's fitting, especially when we find out what this procession is about. It's about... killing and tormenting people accused of sorcery and witchcraft.
Right. We're here for the execution of a warlock and a witch. And there's some narration. You get a voiceover, I think, that's saying like, I don't remember the exact words, but it's basically like, France, you know, before indoor plumbing. Wow. Do you think war and disease are bad? How about Satan?
Yeah, superstition, ignorance, violence. They prepare you for all of it here.
And the Inquisitor's troops here look to me like Two-Face's henchmen in Batman Forever. They've got these goofy red sock masks over their heads. Mm-hmm. That was really kind of nice. And this is also where we get the warlock and the witch are taken to the place of execution. I don't know why it needed to be in the middle of this vast field with the mountains and the stream. But that's where they take them. And then there's some kind of, you know, church official or something who reads out the charges to them.
Yeah. And I think Maurice's ancestor is one of these people as well. So he technically has a double role. Also, one of these peoples is Alaric's brother, who's kind of like this one-eyed Paul Naschy character with like a smug grin on his face and a scar. That is Alaric's brother Armand, it's implied that he kind of helped do his brother in here.
So yeah, they're both played by Naschy. So it's Naschy punishing Naschy.
Yeah. And they read out a full list of charges, which in addition to you are vampires and lycanthropes, there's you have drunk human blood. Of both the living and the dead, you have eaten flesh. Uh-huh. You have celebrated the Black Mass with bloody sacrifices of the newborn and of young girls. Uh-huh. You have adored Satan and of followers of his Sabbath.
Yes. Verbatim, I believe. So, yeah, they put the sorcerers to death. Warlock gets his head chopped off. I don't know how they kill the witch. They, like, hang her upside down or something.
Yeah, and then she screams. It seems like they're commencing to flog her and then cut. She's presumed dead.
Now, here's the thing we discover later. I don't know why this is. When we find their bodies later in the movie, so this is going to be hundreds of years later, obviously they want to be resurrected from the dead. But Paul Naschy's body... he's like an incorruptible saint. Like his body is all there. It still looks like, you know, totally fresh. And his head looks totally fresh. Meanwhile, Helga Linnaeus' body is a skeleton with a wig on it.
Yeah, different supernatural. Well, I guess here's the thing. He is the warlock. He is the one whose body is flowing with unnatural energies. She is his great love. And therefore, she benefits from this sorcery, but she herself is a different type of entity. And later on in the film, we had spelled out directly that there are slightly different rules for killing one versus the other.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, by the way, that opening execution is carried out via a decree from Carcassonne, which was a French fortified city, and of course is also the name of a great German tile-based board game, which absolutely does not have a warlock execution expansion, but I think clearly needs one.
Oh, never played it. What's German style? Is that like Settlers of Catan kind of stuff?
Yeah. This one is one, it's a very calming, very relaxing board game. It's all about building walled cities and connecting them with roads, with tiles. So it kind of, you build it as you go, and then at the end you score everything. And yeah, it's very cool.
Okay, cut to the present day, and then, Rob, I'm going to need some help here. Who are the people, our main characters? We have the Paul Naschy guy, and we have Maurice the painter, and then we have two women, and then some other people.
Yeah, I had to go back and put all this together again, but okay. We have Alaric's descendant, And, well, technically Armand's descendant, but also, I guess, Ulrich's descendant. This is modern day contemporary Paul Naschy, Hugo, and his gal is Sylvia.
Okay.
Then we have Hugo's painter friend, Maurice, who is also, he's a descendant of one of the witch hunters or executors here. Mm-hmm. And his gal is Paula.
Okay. Are Sylvia and Hugo the ones where Sylvia's like, why don't we get married? And Hugo's like, because I'm Paul Naschy.
Basically, yeah. And I don't really remember what Maurice and Paula's whole vibe is other than they love each other.
Yeah.
And so basically they're all like, hey, we should, I forget exactly how they reached this point. Maybe this little research is going on. But they're like, we should go out to the country to Hugo's chalet out there, and we should hire somebody to do a séance so we can get in touch with this head, which, by the way, Maurice keeps seeing in his dreams and in his visions as he's drawn to paint grotesque scenes of decapitation.
Well, now wait, I thought they did the séance before they went to the chalet. Don't they they're still hanging out? They're still in the city, I think.
That's right. Okay, so they do the séance first. And that's the inspiration to then go out into the country and try to find the body and the head of Ulrich, which are deposited in different places.
Yeah, so I think Maurice is like, I'm seeing this head in my dreams, and I'm painting it, and I'm not very smart. And Hugo's like, I don't believe in heads. And then they're like, well, let's have a seance, and that'll tell us what to do. And then the medium at the seance is like, there's a severed head that you must dig up, and it's up in the village at your chalet. And
yeah,
that's
the body's
where they go,
buried in the cloisters. Head is in the crypt of the monastery. And yeah, our city humans here are here like, well, we got to get these two back together again. Let's get this head and this body back together. And so they set out.
Only good can come from it.
Yeah.
I remember they argue about, this is one of the scenes where Hugo is skeptical because they're like, you must believe what Madame Irina said because a spirit was obviously choking her from beyond the grave. And mm-hmm. Hugo's like, well, she must have put on makeup to show those bruises. But then why are they trying to resurrect a spirit that was choking somebody? That seems like, I don't know, that's red flag number one, that like you should not resurrect this spirit.
Yeah, I think so. But what do? They jump in the car, they head out into the countryside. And here we kind of get into we initially get into sort of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre territory of, oh, the city folks have come out into the country, and now they're encountering country folk who are suspicious and dangerous.
Well, and it was weirdly more, I don't know, there's politics within this village or something. So like mm-hmm. they get attacked on the road by bandits. And then some other guys show up and they're like, hey, these are the bandits. And they catch the bandits and just like vigilante justice murder them. But then also, mm-hmm. I think the vigilantes then are essentially bandits also. And they try to extort money from the heroes.
Yeah, and end up selling them a car because when the bandits initially attack, they end up wrecking the car, and they're like, well, we'll sell you one for $3,000. And of course, the lead bandit is watching as Hugo busts out this big roll of money, and you know, he's eyeballing it like, ooh, I'm definitely going to rob these people later.
Yeah.
And that is indeed what they are plotting to do later. We'll come back.
So here I got really confused about how this was happening, but do Hugo and the rest of them hire the villagers to just dig up all around this ancient church and find, they're looking for a box that has a warlock head in it?
Yeah. And I think the villagers are kind of interested in it because there's also talk of there being some sort of a treasure. So they're like, yeah, we'll help you dig this up. We'll even go to that place where they say a demon stalks at night. So they're this weird mix of very superstitious, but also, you know, up for whatever. One of the villagers here that we meet is this Alan character. He has two daughters. One is Chantal and the other is Elvira.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know where some of these characters came from, but so some of the villagers, they find a box, they like dig it up. And I, again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they think it's treasure, So they get real excited and they open it up, like they blowtorch the lock and crack it open. But when they crack it open, it's not treasure. It is a warlock head. And then the warlock head hypnotizes them and turns them into like murderers.
Yeah. Yeah. Alaric's head hypnotizes them and particularly hypnotizes Alan here, the father of Elvira, and has him go around with this huge, scary scythe. This wonderful crooked cutting implement that again I think is quite scary, and has him going around butchering people with that.
Yeah, so for a while here there just seems to be kind of like random roaming sickle guys, and some people are just getting killed and other people are getting hypnotized to go work for the warlock head, the head.
Right.
Because it's not a full warlock yet. It's in fact the most hilarious detail is that there's like a scene where they literally go down into the crypt and they start taking orders from the warlock head. He's like, he can't move his head, so it's really funny like how far his eyes move back and forth when he's looking at the different people, like, what's this now? You know, you must do this.
Very, Templar-esque in terms of, you know, the charges that were leveled against the Templars about the worship of decapitated heads, and reminds me a little bit of the treatment of this idea in C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength as well.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Thank you.
But yeah, the head needs the body. It needs people to help with the body, and some blood needs to be spilled on along the way. And so we do get a series of sickle murders, including Alan killing his own daughter, Chantel, here in a pretty terrifying scene. This is a scene I had to watch a couple of times because I thought it ended up being blocked in in a way that and shot in a way that I found rather effective. There's a certain art to having your brutal, giallo style murders in a film, and they don't always work. Sometimes they come off very fake, or they come off more about showing the blood than sort of teasing the idea of the violence. So this is not one of those scenes where we see a lot of like parting of flesh and see heart getting ripped out and so forth. But there's just like this sudden attack, and then the sickle comes out and there's a sound effect. I thought it worked really well.
Oh, but there is the latter in this movie. There's plenty of that where there's scenes where like there's one where Helga Linnae literally just like reaches into a guy's chest cavity with her fingers and pries his chest apart to get that heart.
Yeah. The chest cat. This is one of those films where, human flesh is just like putty to the undead, and they can just rip right in there and pull out any organ they want.
This is another sequence, though, where I was like, when people were getting sickled, I did not know who was who, and I was confused. When somebody, like, it seems like somebody turns up dead, and then the next scene, somebody goes, well, she's sleeping now. And I was like, well, but wasn't she dead? But then I think maybe they're talking about another character who was present, so I don't know.
Yeah, this is one of those films, too, where on one hand, the script was allegedly written in like 2 days. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, too, it's like we're dealing with the Grindhouse era dubbing, where it wasn't really about necessarily making sure that all the intricacies of the original dialogue are maintained. It's about getting that product out, right?
So at some point after this, there is a scene where both Sylvia and Maurice get hypnotized to go work for the warlock, right? So mm-hmm. like Maurice goes out walking, and then he gets hypnotized by hypnotized Sylvia, and they all end up going down into the crypt. And that's where the warlock head starts talking to them. This was another laugh out loud scene for me. Again, anytime the head is talking without the body, I found it very funny. And he gives mm-hmm. a full Bond villain monologue, but as a severed head sitting in a box talking. And I had to transcribe this. I thought it was great. So he's like, you, Maurice, he says the last name, I don't remember what it is. So, you, Maurice, with the blood of my enemies running through your veins, you will serve and help me accomplish my vengeance. Today, the faithful companion, Mabille de Lacrae, will return, and in the space of 7 moons, and when the heavens are propitious, our power will be at its maximum strength, so that we can exterminate all those who executed us, and our unbounded hatred will make all mankind tremble, and thereby we will thus be avenged.
All right, sounds like a plan.
And thereby we will thus be avenged. I think this warlock in his day job may have been a lawyer. It's very contracty kind of language.
Well, I think that's fair. Back in the day, like, what was a warlock but a lawyer who dealt mainly with one client, that being the Lord of the Pit himself, Lord Satan.
But also in the scene, this is, I think, the resurrection scene where the warlock and Mabille are sort of brought back. So, like, they put the warlock's head back on his body, and mm-hmm. somehow they turn Mabille from a skeleton with a wig on into Helga Linnae.
Oh, God, this scene is great. Yes, so the resurrected Alaric here, his one piece again, he places the unconscious Sylvia upon the skeletal remains in the casket, slices open her chest, and then he kind of necrophilatically resurrects Mabille. He like kind of like lays on top of these two bodies in the casket, and then the next shot is Mabille is rising up out of the casket, like the bones of her old bones like spilling to the side, and she's back, baby. And then Alaric kills Alan and cuts out his heart. So just a great sequence of events here.
I guess.
Like I say, they're a power couple. You can't help but feel their energy and get behind them here.
Yeah, they're clearly happy to be reunited. They are ready to go do copious evil together.
Yes.
So I think there's like a scene where they're getting it was not clear, but they're like getting revenge on the descendants of the people who executed them. I think they're just going and like attacking random villagers.
I guess this was part of the vengeance, or it might have just been a situation of like, we got to power up and eat more hearts. Uh-huh. But yeah, there are these wonderful scenes where Alaric and Mabel go off to love up and kill other characters. I'm not sure these are necessarily characters that we had met before. Mabel finds a young villager dude. She strips nude and he gets nude, and then she back scratches him to death.
Yep.
And then Alaric's occult charisma causes a villager woman to strip nude. So he strips nude, and this is when we get to see Physique by Nashi here. And then they climb into bed together. Cut to villager dude with his back slashed. Cut to nude woman dead with her heart cut out.
I think this is a John Saxon situation, though, where like Nashi clearly, he's like, I got to show my chest in this movie. People need to see these muscles.
Yeah.
So he found ways to work it in.
It also made me look up, as with John Saxon, I had to look up old bodybuilding photographs. And yeah, you see, I found some old Paul Nashi shots of him in like full bodybuilder mode. And yeah, pretty impressive.
Okay, now there's some like magic dynamics where there's like a magical amulet that pops up sometime around here in the movie. And I was trying my hardest to figure out, did we already know something about this? Or is this just out of nowhere? Like, oh yeah, there is an amulet that will defeat the warlock.
Yeah, this kind of comes out of nowhere, as I recall. Elvira, the local girl, and ultimately she's going to be our final girl here. She's like, oh, by the way, I just remembered something. There's this Thor's hammer amulet, and it can destroy powerful undead creatures.
Oh.
So useful information to suddenly have. And also, we later learn, and I don't remember how we learn this, but we learn that Thor's hammer will not outright destroy a female undead, a female resurrected being. No, for that, you need a long silver needle.
Right. So, yeah, the hammer only works on Paul Nashi, the warlock Paul Nashi. Mm-hmm. I remember how they find this out. They open up a book and they're reading the book. And I'm like, what is this book? I don't know if they ever explain what the book is. They just have a book that tells you how to kill the warlock.
This was the research portion of the movie. I forgot about this.
But so there is a scene where after this, like the remaining humans include Hugo, who is... and unhypnotized at this point. That's regular Paul Nashi. Mm-hmm. And Elvira, and I think maybe somebody else, I don't know. So zombies attack the house, and it's really, this was also very funny because I think we get Alan, the guy from the village, talking to Elvira, and he's like, Elvira, my daughter, open the door. And he sounds like Dracula, but she's like, oh, dad. But when the zombies get into the house, they are vocal fry zombies. They are just wandering the halls going nonstop until there's a torch standoff. Paul Nashi lights up a torch and waves it at them. He does an awful lot of waving that torch. That goes on for a mm-hmm. while. And eventually he gets them out of the house. He's like, shoo, shoo. And, you know, they get out the door. And then he, I think, tries to burn them, but I don't know if it exactly works because later he's like looking for their bodies in the lake or something.
He there's a brief Burning Man stunt here where he catches one of the zombies on fire, or at least catches the pants in the back on fire.
Uh huh.
So yeah, basically Night of the Living Dead scenario here with dead villagers. They're able to successfully fight them off until dawn.
After this, Maurice comes back, the painter guy, and he's like, well, I'm not hypnotized by the warlock anymore. Hugo's like, oh, great. Well, then I need you to go help me do something. We're going to need an axe and some wood. And then he says to Elvira, so they're leaving the house, and he's like, you stay here. This is a direct quote. It's going to be disagreeable. You'll be in no danger, even if you're alone. What's the basis for that?
I guess it's because it's daytime. The sun is out. Yeah.
Oh, that could be it.
And she shouldn't see what they're going to do. What they are going to do, this is the scene, the following sequence, I think I watched three different times and finally consulted a summary to really nail down what they were trying to do in this sequence.
What are they trying to do? So they go to the lake, and the lake is making bubbling tar pit sounds, and I don't know why. But that
and they have they have an axe, and they have firewood, and they have like a big long pole with a hook on it, like they're going to drag the lake. Apparently, they have come out here to find the bodies of the zombies from last night, any remaining bodies, and burn them.
But they don't quite get to do that because Maurice was not so unpossessed after all. Looks like this was all a trap.
That's right. A brutal betrayal in which Maurice, possessed Maurice, kills Hugo with a shotgun.
So this is regular Paul Naschy is dead now. Only Warlock Paul Naschy remains.
Right. And again, I was kind of surprised by this because I thought it was going to ultimately be Naschy versus Naschy. But instead, no, only Alaric remains.
But, however, I think Maurice is genuinely awakened from his hypnotized state by the Thor's hammer amulet. Like, I think, what's her name? Elvira presses that against him, and then he's like, oh, I'm good now. And then that's when they read the book. They just start reading a book, and it tells them how to kill warlocks and zombies and the Silver Needle and all that. Meanwhile, this is when we get the argument between the warlock and Helga Linnae about when they should eat hearts. You know, I will eat hearts later, but I'm hungry now. And they settle this by going out to find the bandits or the vigilantes from earlier who are camped out with a fire by the riverbank. And they just say, hi, we're going to eat your hearts now. And they do. This is where Mabille like rips the dude's chest open with her hands.
Nice. So many chests get ripped open in this film. And this all leads up to our final showdown. So on one hand, we have Maurice, and we have Elvira, and then we also have Alaric and Mabille, and Elvira and Maurice. They have the weapons now. They feel like they know what they need to do. They have the amulet. They have the needle. And so the battle begins. Basically, the way this is, I thought this was a nice final showdown, but ultimately, Maurice and Alaric both throw items at each other at the same time. Maurice is throwing the Thor amulet, and Alaric is throwing an axe. So Maurice is killed by the axe. Meanwhile, the amulet hits Alaric and wounds him. Elvira is fighting Mabille and stabs her with a silver needle, which just destroys her. And then Elvira picks up the amulet and presses it to the wounded Alaric's head. And this results in a nice dramatic death sequence for Paul Naschy's Alaric.
So Elvira survives the warlock horror.
That's right. Alaric, he like falls to his knees, his head falls off, his body and his head tumble down some stairs and then just burn to a crisp.
They end up looking, they're kind of like a smoldering orange newspapers, it looks like.
Yeah. And then Elvira, in kind of a daze, she wanders back down to the lake, and she throws the Thor amulet into the water, and that's the end of the movie.
Now, I was confused by that. Why'd she throw the amulet in the water? The amulet wasn't bad. The amulet protected them from evil. How does she know that she's not going to need that again?
I don't know. I mean, she seemed to think it belonged there. I don't know if she was like, I've had enough of this. I'm throwing this into the water. If this is like throwing Goose's dog tags into the ocean in Top Gun. I don't know if this is like Excalibur needs to be returned to the lake. And so she's throwing it into the lake. I'm not sure exactly what the rationale was here other than to have a kind of haunting, ambiguous ending to the whole affair.
Yeah.
Which is sort of what we had in the Lorelei's Grasp. We had a haunting, ambiguous ending by the lakeshore.
That's right, yeah. Except this movie, unlike Lorelei's Grasp, does not have a doomed monster romance component. It does not have, like, the human falls in love with a monster. If there is a love story, it's the love story between two evil monsters. And unfortunately, they are both thwarted by bumbling humans in the end.
Well, Alaric is clearly upset when his loved one dies again. Like, we do get a moment of him reacting to that. And I felt bad for him. Because, again, I was 100% behind this power couple. I'm not sure what their modern power couple name would be, combining Alaric and Mabille. I'll leave that for...
Malaric, yeah.
Malaric, Team Malaric, yeah. I was 100% on Team Malaric. So, yeah, I was a little sad when things went down the way they did.
I think Naschy's look as the warlock is far superior to his look as a modern day man. So
definitely.
Yeah, on one hand, he's wearing this gross pale makeup, and he always looks sweaty, and he's got this fake beard, and he's got the cool cape and everything, and that all just gels. That works. And the other version,
there's an actual gel too. There's an actual red gel or purple gel. So he has this demonic light to him, and he's just got this sardonic look on his face. Absolutely love this look.
That look works. And when you compare that to his look as the modern man who tucks his turtleneck in, it's not the same.
Right. before we close out, one more Maurice moment that I love. There's a part earlier in the film where they've gone out into the country and he comes back from town. I'm not sure what he was doing in town, but he's talking to Hugo and he's like, yeah, this place sucks. Like, I went into town and the kids were throwing rocks at me.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I did not know what that meant, but it was funny.
All right. The movie is Horror Rises from the Tomb. It's a lot of fun. At some point in the future, I may have to come back and look around at some of these Paul Naschy werewolf films and figure out what might be the Paul Naschy werewolf film to watch. I'm not sure. But if anyone out there has any ideas, feel free to write in and let us know. All right. In the meantime, if you want to listen to other Weird House Cinema episodes, you'll find them in the Stuff to Blow Your Mind podcast feed every Friday. We're mainly a science podcast, but once a week we like to set aside everything that's serious and just talk about a weird film. Get that wherever you get your podcasts. If you want a full list of the movies we've covered, there are two places you can go for that, aside from the episode feed. You can go to Letterboxd, that's Letterboxd. And if you look up the account Weird House, you'll find a list there with all the movies in there. So you can get this nice visual of everything that we've covered and sometimes a glimpse at what we're going to cover. I also blog about these at a personal blog titled Some Muta Music, so you can go there as well.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.